On May 3, 2005, in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! Came and spoke for Seacoast Peace Response, Seacoast Alliance for Democracy, WSCA, and numerous other organizations. There's a crowd of over 400 people there to hear her inspiring and impassioned talk. That talk was recorded by Stanley Longstaff and provided to us to share with you today. We hope you enjoy it.
I'd like to introduce to you one of my media heroes and my big sister, Amy Goodman, the host of Democracy Now!
It's an extremely important anniversary, the eve of May 4th, May 4th, 1970, following President Richard Nixon's announcement that the United States and South Vietnamese forces had invaded Cambodia, the campus of Kent State University in Ohio. Student protesters on one side, the National Guard on the other. 13 seconds, a hail of bullets, 67 shots fired, 4 students dead, 9 injured. 10 days later, Jackson State, 2 students killed. The price of dissent should not be that high. And the way we prevent that from happening again is by making dissent commonplace in America. We need a media that is a sanctuary of dissent. And that's why we're on our Unembed the Media tour, demanding that we have an independent media in this country. It is absolutely critical, more powerful than any bomb, than any missile. The media, the Pentagon, has deployed the U.S. media. The media are the most powerful institutions on earth. We have to take them back. I come from Pacifica Radio. It was founded 56 years ago by a man named Lou Hill, conscientious objector, World War II. When he came out of the detention camps, he said there has to be a media outlet not run by corporations that profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. Not run by corporations, as George Gerbner from the University of Pennsylvania Communications Department says, not run by corporations that have nothing to tell and everything to sell, that are raising our children today. And so the first Pacifica station, KPFA, went on the air in 1949. Second station, KPFK in Los Angeles, 1959. 1960, my station, WBAI, went on the air. 1970, KPFT in Houston. 1977, WPFW in Washington. The 5 Pacifica stations. And then our programming going out to stations all over the country. It's very exciting. The growth right now of Democracy Now!, I hesitate to use the term explosive, but several years ago, we were broadcasting on several dozen community radio stations around the country, and that was wonderful. Now we broadcast on over 330 Pacifica radio stations and affiliates, increasingly NPR stations, where often we beat Morning Edition and All Things Considered hands down in fundraising. And it is an honor to be able to support public radio in that way, bringing in a very diverse audience, a younger audience, and a very loyal audience. We travel from state to state, city to city. We hold fundraisers for community radio stations and public access TV stations where we also broadcast. Public access TV, extremely important. Some of you may not even know your public access TV station, but in the same way that people fought for community radio, for public radio in this country, they fought for public access. A media corporation comes into a town, maybe it's Comcast, maybe it's Cox, maybe it's Time Warner or Cablevision. Only one gets to dig up the roads to lay the cable. And then, because they get the monopoly in a town, media activists wrested a public space from them. Few public interest channels that the community can use, just like community radio. And when the company comes back to renegotiate, they try to take those channels back. But when people use them, make their own media there, don't forget it's where most people get their information from television. Actually, from the late night comics. But it's so important. We become media literate, and the way to do that is to make our own media. We're on PBS stations, and we're on both satellite networks. Maybe some of you watch Free Speech TV on Dish Network Channel 9415, show of hands, or 9410 Link TV, or if you have DirecTV, Channel 375 Link TV. And we video and audio stream at democracynow.org. Millions of people access the program. And we are closed captioned for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. 2 to 3 new stations a week are picking us up. And so as the program grows, it has been extremely exhilarating to reach new audiences across the political spectrum, because I very much think that political lines, unlike what the media reports, the blue and the red, Pacifica talks about the purple strategy, but I don't think it's so simple. I think conservative Republicans, like progressives, deeply care about Social Security, about corporate control, about issues of privacy, about an out-of-control war budget, about young men and women and not-so-young men and women coming home from Iraq in body bags, which is why the administration has invoked this executive order that says that you can't videotape or photograph those flag-draped coffins coming home. They know the power of the images, as we also this week, the 30th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War, the power of those images, how important they are. You think of the reasons they give for not photographing the flag-draped coffin to do with respect and privacy. Let's think about the week that the world stopped as the Pope died, the total coverage in St. Peter's Square. The Pope allowed himself to be seen as he got increasingly debilitated. Thought it was important to show people what that looks like as people come to the end of their lives. And then when he died, we saw his body laid out and then in the coffin. All of it deeply respectful. The whole world understood the finality that a life had ended. And I think that's exactly what you're not supposed to understand, that sinking in of now close to 1,600 U.S. servicemen and women dead in Iraq. The power of the images that we should be seeing. It is not our role as journalists to sanitize the images. We are reporters, not entertainers. We're supposed to go to where the silence is. I don't like the whole reality TV craze, but I think we need a little reality TV when it comes to war. This has been an amazing journey over the last few weeks. Tomorrow we head to Louisville, Kentucky, then Bloomington, Indiana, then I think it's Albuquerque, and then Minneapolis, and then back to New York, and it goes on from there. We traveled to Omaha, Nebraska, then Lincoln, Nebraska, where a new radio station has just taken us on. It's wonderful to be broadcast right here on WSCA, and to have such an honored spot. I was just saying earlier at the fundraiser for the low-power FM station here that the Pentagon has called the embedding process a spectacular success. The words of Victoria Clark, right, the former spokesperson for Hill & Knowlton becomes Pentagon spokesperson, now CNN consultant. I think the line is a very instructive one. She called it a spectacular success, the embedding of the media, which is precisely why it is such a disaster for the media. The media the government understood the power of pictures after Vietnam, and I think the new motto is, if you can't beat them, join them up. Join them up. Enlist them. And so the reporters have been enlisted. We have to challenge all of that. There are ways to break through. But before I go into that, a story I've often told on this trip, I wanted to stay back when Pacifica was born, which was the dawn of the nuclear age. Right now in New York, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Conference is taking place. Yesterday, went to a conference, and so many people were there from all over the world, deeply concerned about the fate of the Earth. Today, we spoke to Daniel Ellsberg, whose life spans from World War II through Vietnam War, such a significant figure. But let's go back to World War II. The embedding process didn't just start now. We have a chapter in The Exception to the Rulers called Hiroshima Cover-Up. We go back to World War II right afterwards, the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and compare two reporters' coverage. One is Wilfred Burchett, an independent reporter. The other, William Lawrence of the New York Times. Wilfred Burchett, after the bombs were dropped, made his way to Japan. The U.S. military, General MacArthur, declared the whole area of southern Japan off limits. Most of the press went off the coast to a barge to cover the Japanese surrender. But Wilfred Burchett needed to see the dawn of the nuclear age with his own eyes, and so he got on a train for 30 hours, and he made his way to Hiroshima. When he got out, he was devastated by the devastation, had never seen anything like it, though he had covered much conflict and war. He saw people with their skin melting off, shadows ingrained in the sides of buildings, people dying not from the initial impact, but from something else. He didn't even have the words to describe. He talked about an atomic plague, a bomb sickness. And he sat down in the rubble with his Hermes typewriter, and he tapped out the words, "I write this as a warning to the world." It was a report that rocked the world, and the U.S. military went into high gear to deal. General Leslie Groves, who headed the Manhattan Project, which developed the atomic bomb, brought reporters back to New Mexico, led by William Lawrence of the New York Times, to counter the Japanese propaganda, the propaganda that there was radiation sickness causing people to die. William Lawrence wrote a series of articles. In the New York Times, there was the headline, "No Radiation Sickness Found at Hiroshima." He won the Pulitzer Prize for his reports. It turned out also that he was on the payroll of the Pentagon, writing the press releases, writing the reports in the New York Times. I guess you couldn't call that plagiarism, since they were both his own words, but we've called for the Times to be stripped of that Pulitzer. It's so important that the example be set early on. The media must be separate from the state. It is not a comfortable position. There's a reason why our profession, journalism, is the only one explicitly protected by the U.S. Constitution, because we're supposed to be the check and balance on government. That is our role. Also staying back then, as we go from the war abroad to the war at home, let's remember what happened. And as we travel through Arizona last weekend in Tucson and Flagstaff and Scottsdale, That is the epicenter of the crackdown on immigrants from Latin America. More than 20 laws in the Arizona state legislature going after immigrants coming over the border. But it's also a time of crackdown for another group of immigrants. Well, always African Americans in this country are under siege. But now Muslims, Arab Americans, people of South Asian descent. We have to learn the lessons of the past. Thousands of them since 9/11 have been arrested. We don't know their names. They don't even know the charges against them. Many have been deported in secret airlifts that take place in the middle of the night. And then, of course, there's Guantanamo and other prisons around the world that we don't even know about, that people have been rendered to, some call it kidnapped. But it goes way back, 1942, the roundup of 120,000 Japanese Americans. If you remember, a very shameful chapter in U.S. history. When we started our Unembed the Media tour, we were in Los Angeles. That night, I hadn't learned yet that that day Fred Korematsu had died. The report came out in the Times, the Los Angeles Times and the Seattle Times the next day. Fred Korematsu, 86 years old, Japanese American who refused to be detained. Oh, they caught him. He was put in a horse stall in a San Francisco stadium and then shipped off to Topaz, Utah. But he didn't stop fighting. He fought in the courts. And his case made its way all the way to the Supreme Court, and he failed every step of the way, right to the top court. He was so ashamed that he failed his people, not just Japanese Americans, but all Americans. They didn't tell his kids about this for decades because he had failed, he felt. But then a legal historian named Peter Irons learned about his case in the early 1980s. He got a hold of a couple of dusty old boxes wrapped in string that contained the documents of Korematsu's case. They hadn't been looked at since the 1940s. And there he found the lie. I want to read from the Seattle Times. I think it was a reprint of a Los Angeles Times piece. Peter Irons finds the part where he opens the documents and he sees this memo from a Justice Department lawyer to U.S. Solicitor General Charles Fahey, the person responsible for arguing the government's side in cases before the Supreme Court. In the memo, the Justice Department accused Fahey of lying to the Supreme Court. In one example, the Justice Department strongly disputed the basis of the claim by a General DeWitt that people whose ancestry was Japanese, which DeWitt considered an enemy race, were engaging in extensive radio signaling and an inshore-to-ship signaling to Japanese ships. Such activity, which would be evidence of treason, had formed a primary basis for the internment. But the Justice Department memo asserted DeWitt, in fact, had no evidence that overt acts of treason were being committed. There were some indications that the signaling was nothing more than kids going to outdoor toilets at night with flashlights. Even FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover and officials at the FCC agreed there was nothing to the signaling reports. The 1944 Justice Department memo stated, "Since this is not so, it is highly unfair to this racial minority that these lies put out in an official publication go uncorrected." Peter Irons says, "I was totally astounded. Then it struck me that this was evidence of a crime to present lies to the Supreme Court." And so he brought the information to a judge, U.S. District Judge Marilyn Hall Patel, who set a preliminary hearing for November 10, 1983, in a larger ceremonial courtroom, anticipating the many internees and their families who would want to witness the historic hearing. Toward the end of the hearing, in an unusual move, Patel invited Fred Korematsu, he was 64 years old then, to speak. The courtroom stilled as Korematsu spoke for several minutes, said, "As long as my record stands in federal court, any American citizen can be held in prison or concentration camps without a trial or a hearing," he said. Everyone expected the judge to take the case under submission for a later ruling, as would be normal. But in another surprise, she ruled from the bench, saying she intended to both vacate the conviction and make formal findings of fact, everything Korematsu's attorneys had asked for. The judge later remembered, "I don't think I was quite prepared for the response. There wasn't a dry eye in the courtroom." Peter Irons was sitting next to Fred Korematsu. He said the audience was stunned. They had just witnessed an unprecedented event that this whole internment issue had been resolved by a court 40 years later in their favor. In her later ruling vacating the Korematsu conviction, the judge said in part, "Korematsu stands as a caution that in times of distress, the shield of military necessity and national security must not be used to protect governmental actions from close scrutiny and accountability." 1983, a federal judge, a federal commission unanimously concluded the factors that shaped the internment decision were race, prejudice, war hysteria, and a failure of political leadership rather than military necessity. In 1988, President Reagan declared the internment a grave injustice, signed legislation authorizing reparations of $20,000 each to thousands of surviving internees, including Korematsu. In 1999, President Clinton awarded Fred Korematsu the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He said, "In the long history of our country's constant search for justice, some names of ordinary citizens stand for millions of souls, Plessy, Brown, Parks. To that distinguished list today," Clinton said, "we add the name of Fred Korematsu." And you would think at that point, Fred Korematsu could finally rest. He had been vindicated. He could tell his children what he had done, and he could stand proud. But he didn't stop. In 2003, a frail and aged Fred Korematsu reemerged to fight again, this time on behalf of detainees being held without charge and without access to attorneys, notably over 600 prisoners on Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Korematsu filed a friend of the court brief in support of the Guantanamo detainees who were being held indefinitely and without charge at the whim of the U.S. government. Korematsu has said of his experience defending civil liberties, "In order for things like this to never happen, we have to protest, so don't be afraid to speak up." Fred Korematsu died 2 weeks ago, an American hero. And it brings us back still to World War II, to the famous quote of that pastor, Martin Niemöller. "First they came for the communists. I wasn't a communist, so I didn't speak up. Then they came for the socialists. I wasn't a socialist, so I didn't speak up. Then they came for the trade unionists. I wasn't a trade unionist, so I didn't speak up. They came for the Jews and the Catholics. I was neither, so I didn't speak up. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak up." Fred Korematsu spoke up. The media provides a forum for us all to speak. That's why it's so important that we stand together, not agree with each other on every issue by any means, but stand up together so that it makes it harder to target any individual or any group of people. I wanted to move forward to the Persian Gulf War because there are cracks in the system where we can break the sound barrier. How many of you have heard me tell the Sally Jesse Raphael story? You can correct me if I make any mistakes. And by the way, that's Dennis Moynihan. He's the outreach coordinator of Democracy Now, and he's handing out the Democracy Now! Daily Digest email list, where you can sign up and get the daily headlines of Democracy Now! As well as the media alerts. But it was Persian Gulf War. Remember the media landscape then. I think it was Westinghouse that owned CBS. Now it's Viacom. General Electric owned NBC. It still does. You had two of the major nuclear weapons manufacturers making most of the parts for most of the weapons in the Persian Gulf War. Owning two of the major media outlets, was it any accident? What we watched on TV was a military hardware show. But I was on WBAI criticizing the bombing of Iraq, bombing the cradle of civilization back to the cradle. It was during fundraising. And I hope you all support your local community radio stations and show up during fundraising to make sure that they raise the money they need to. And a young volunteer ran into the studio and said, the Sally Jesse Raphael show is on the line. I said, yeah, right. So I just kept on going. And she kept coming in. Volunteers are the heart of everything we do. I just thought this one was hallucinating. But anyway, to appease her, I picked up the phone. And sure enough, there was a producer. She said she was listening in her limousine. I guess the chauffeur had turned on the program. And she asked if I would join them for the show 2 days later. They wanted to have a panel of women, three for and against the war. I said I could talk about what people were saying, and certainly as we document the peace movement, what people there felt. And then I got off the phone. I was a little bit shocked. I thought, you know, what am I going to wear? So, you know, like, this is a big moment. Millions of people, like, are watching. These shows affect millions of people, especially women. I could dress as a man pretending to be a woman who is actually a man, masquerading as a woman, because I wanted to fit in, and I knew what these kinds of shows were all about. I didn't want to shock anyone. But anyway, I figured out what to do, and I went on down to the program. And they put us in two different green rooms, the women for the war and the women against the war. And the producer came out and said she didn't want us to meet until we went out on the stage. Now, she said she wanted us to duke it out on the stage. You know, the whole Jerry Springer thing and everything. I was a little bit nervous. The other five women, three, four, and two against, were all military. But I don't think any of us were armed. So anyway, the young producer said, no, really, I want the show to get the ratings that all the other ones get, because I want to prove we can take on issues that have meaning. And I thought she was onto something. I don't think it matters if you work inside the system or outside the system. What matters is that you can accomplish what you want to. And if you can, no matter how painful, stay there and do it. So we went out on the stage, and the lights came on, and the music came up, and Sally came out, and she immediately handed her microphone to a woman in the audience who said, I'm really concerned about Saddam Hussein's chemical and biological weapons. To which the woman next to me responded. Her name was Dr. Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn. She was an Army captain trained as a doctor, trained to, she said, save lives, not take them, and she was refusing to go to the Gulf. And she said, I share your concern, but I think it's important to point out that we have biological and chemical weapons right here in the United States. And before she could get out the word states, Sally whirled around and she came barreling down the aisle and she started shouting, you be quiet, this is my show, you shut up or get out. Now, I hadn't really seen this program very much. And she was coming down at such a velocity. And here was Dr. Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn. She's dressed in this long black dress, big glasses, hair tied back, very soft-spoken, hands clasped in her lap. And, you know, that whole thing, we want you to duke it out on the stage. Sally was coming up, it looked like right on the stage. I thought she was going to strike Dr. Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn. And I said, whoa, Sally, back off. And they had told us to bring our friends, and I brought people from WBAI to fill the audience, and they started chanting, free speech, free speech. You can dress them up, but you can't take them anywhere. So Sally started to break down. She stopped the taping of the program, and her producers came out, and they started to rock her back and forth, saying, that's okay, Sally, that's okay. It was the one moment of unity for the six women on the stage. We're just in shock. I mean, if these few anti-war words could rock this woman's world in this way, could you imagine if they actually got out to the rest of the country? But it didn't look like that was going to happen. Until somehow her producers convinced her to carry on with the taping of the show. It was going to air 2 days later. Well, there was one caveat. We would have to raise our hands if we had anything to say. I hadn't seen anything like that except on Sesame Street, but we agreed. And so the show went on. And it was good. It was a very good show. And we went back and forth, and Sally asked me, she showed videotape of protesters in Washington. She asked me, who are these people? I didn't know everyone's name. And I'm not into naming names, but you know, I said something like, these are people who believe peace is patriotic, that to support the troops is to say they should come home, something like that. I mean, let's face it. Most Americans do not identify with 10,000, 30,000, 100,000 people screaming in the streets. But what choice do these people have? They're not invited into a network studio to have civilized one-on-one discussions to explain why they oppose war. So they can only hope on a global warming day a CBS executive will open a window and that chant of no war will waft in and maybe hit an open microphone. Anyway, I didn't say all that, but we went on. And I said, as the granddaughter of an Orthodox rabbi, I am horrified to see little Israeli children wearing gas masks. But I am more horrified to see little Palestinian children without gas masks. And that's the kind of conversation we had for the hour. My grandfather died years ago, but my grandmother, we just celebrated her 108th birthday. And so the show went on, and at the end of it, the cameraman gave us the thumbs up. I went back to WBAI, and it was going to air in 2 days, and 2 days came and went, and the show didn't air. So I called up. I said, what's up? And the producer said, well, there was a problem with the syncing of the sound in the video. And I said, right. I started to get that syncing feeling, and I said, I think you had a problem with the sound of our voices. And she said, don't be like that. We'll have you back another time. And I said, you know, that can't happen because Dr. Yolanda Hewitt-Vaughn is going to jail. Yes, she was court-martialed, sentenced to 3 years in prison. She lived just under death row in the brig. A while ago, I was in St. Louis. We were celebrating KDHX TV, KDHX Radio and DHTV, which is public access TV there. And afterwards, I was signing books and a young man came up. And I said, who do I sign this to? And he said, oh, just to me, to Emiliano Hewitt Vaughn. This was Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn's son. He was 8 years old when his mother was imprisoned with his two younger siblings raised by their father as she was in prison. And she actually was freed after 8 months because Amnesty International adopted her as a prisoner of conscience. And Emiliano helped to start an amnesty chapter in his high school, hoping he could free someone else's mother like his mother had been freed. As Margaret Mead said, never doubt for a moment that a small group of thoughtful, committed people can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. So I said to the producer, I want to speak to the executive producer now. And she said, he's a very busy man. So many people were calling us at BAI, you know, where's the show? I said, I don't know. Call the Sally Jesse Raphael show. Don't bog down our switchboard. I guess they got hundreds of calls. All I know is that 2 days later, I got a call from a frantic high-level producer who said that the executive producer wants to speak to me now. I said, I'm a very busy woman. And they asked if I would cry censorship if they edited the program. I said, of course not. I'm an editor too. As Sally pointed out, this is her show. I assume you'll edit out her fit. And they did. But because they held on to the program, it ran with headlines around the country that said, things get messy with Sally Jesse. And the most interesting response I got was from women on southern military bases who called to say, we've never heard this view on television before, and we agree with you. Here were women who were being sent to war, or their loved ones were, being sent to kill or be killed. I don't know which is worse. And they were saying that they can't have these debates on military bases. They rely on us and civilian society to have these critical discussions. I see the media as a huge kitchen table that stretches across this country, that we all sit around and debate and discuss the most important issues of the day, war and peace, life and death. And anything less than that is a disservice to the servicemen and women of this country, is a disservice to a democratic society. I come from ground zero, just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. We were broadcasting Democracy Now! When the second plane hit the second tower of the World Trade Center. The first plane hit at 8:47. At the time, we broadcast at 9. Now we broadcast at 8 every morning. The second plane hit at 9:03. We'd already started our show. We didn't know what was happening. We work out of a 100-year-old firehouse, decommissioned firehouse. It's now a community media center. At the time, we broadcast out of the garret. Now we've taken over the whole first floor where the horse and buggies used to carry out the water. And there were no windows in the attic of the firehouse. And so we were just carrying on with the show. We were doing a special that day on the connection between terror and September 11th, 1973, the day Salvador Allende died in the palace in Chile as the Pinochet forces rose to power. The U.S.-backed Pinochet forces, the Nixon-backed Pinochet forces, the Kissinger-backed Pinochet forces, the ITT-backed Pinochet forces, Anaconda Copper-backed Pinochet forces. Pinochet reigned for 17 years, killing thousands of Chileans. It's not the first time September 11th was connected to terror. September 11th, 1990, Guatemalan anthropologist Myrna Mack died at the hands of U.S.-backed Guatemalan security forces. September 11, 1977, South Africa, Steve Biko, founder of the Black Consciousness Movement, was being beaten to death in the back of a van by U.S.-backed apartheid forces, died in the early morning hours of September 12. September 11, 1971, Attica, the uprising, prisoners protesting prison conditions 2 days later. Then New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller called out the New York State Troopers. They opened fire, killing 39 men, including guards, critically wounding 88 others, injuring hundreds more. September 11th, 2001 is not the first time terror came to U.S. soil. Ask any African American about slavery. Ask any Native American about what's happened in this country. But September 11th, 2001 was a horrific moment. 3,000 people incinerated in an instant. We'll never actually know how many people died on that day, because those who go uncounted in life go uncounted in death. And they're the undocumented workers who worked at the World Trade Center. And we should know their names. We should know their stories. That's what dignifies a life. We hunkered down in the firehouse. The military police had cordoned off the whole area. We were within the evacuation zone. But we knew we had to keep broadcasting. We're the closest national broadcast to Ground Zero. Could quickly see the war machine gearing up in Washington, yet there were so many who had lost loved ones who were saying no. People like Rita Lazar, who lost her brother Abe Zalmanowicz on the 27th floor of the World Trade Center. She was 70 years old. Her son, Matthew Lazar, is the author of Pacifica, The Rise of an Alternative Network. It was his uncle, Abe. Abe's brother was screaming at him on the cell phone to get out of the towers now. He worked for Blue Cross Blue Shield, and he was working next to his best friend, Ed, who is a paraplegic. And he said as soon as the emergency workers come up and help Ed down, they'd go down together. And they died with so many others. And then there was Phyllis and Orlando Rodriguez, who lost their son, Greg Ernesto Rodriguez, above the 100th floor of the World Trade Center. He worked for Cantor Fitzgerald. They lost 700 of 1,000 workers. A few days later, President Bush gave his National Cathedral Address, and he invoked the story of Abe Zalmanowicz, calling him a national hero, and Rita said no. And she wrote a letter to the New York Times that actually got published. And she said even if she knew the worst pain of her life, it would only increase her suffering to know that a woman in Afghanistan would soon lose her brother. She said, not in my name, not in my brother's name. And Phyllis and Orlando Rodriguez, remembering Greg with their family, also wrote a letter to President Bush. It swirled around the internet. And they said it would not lessen their pain to know that a mother and father in Afghanistan would soon lose their son. They said, not in our name, not in our son's name. And a nationwide movement grew up, not in our name, September 11th families for peaceful tomorrows. Sometimes we'd see them on television describing their loved ones. But when they move from description to prescription, what should happen? Then the media cut away, and they went to the experts in terrorism. Oliver North, Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger was one who said, we should not only go after the terrorists, but bomb the countries they come from. And I got nervous because I live in the same city as Henry Kissinger. I don't say that lightly. You know, maybe the media got it right in that case. The experts in terrorism, it takes one to know one. You look at Henry Kissinger's record. You look at his role in the support of Pinochet in Chile. Thousands of Chileans die. You look at his role in support of the generals of the dirty war of Argentina. Just last week, our headlines on Democracy Now, you can check them out at democracynow.org. We reported on an Argentine military official sentenced to 640 years in prison. He was one of those involved with the death flights in Argentina, where they take the prisoners up in the plane and they drop them out. And then just a few days later, we reported on the police official who was also just sentenced in Argentina for stealing the babies of dissident women and selling them to military officials to raise. You know, after September 11th, when we were in the firehouse, we'd go out late at night and we'd see those pictures go up everywhere. They became so familiar, hundreds of them, thousands of them all over the city, plastered on the sides of hospitals, on park benches, on lampposts. That picture of a woman holding her baby, and it would say, if you've seen my wife, last seen above the 47th floor of the World Trade Center, please call her husband, and there would be a phone number. Or a picture of a young man. And it would say, if you've seen my son, last seen in Tower 2, please call his mother, and a phone number. And I thought about how similar those pictures were to those carried on the posters of the mothers of the disappeared in Argentina as they walked the Plaza de Mayo. Have you seen my granddaughter? Have you seen my grandson? September 11th united us with people around the world against terror. I do think that Osama bin Laden and his accomplices should be tried for what happened on September 11th. But I also think that Henry Kissinger should be tried for war crimes. Chile, Argentina, Vietnam, millions dead. Indonesia and East Timor. The day before Indonesia invaded East Timor in 1975, Henry Kissinger, Secretary of State, with President Ford, went to Indonesia, Jakarta, the capital, met with Suharto, the long-reigning dictator, and gave the go-ahead for the invasion. One of the great slaughters of the 20th century, 90% of the weapons used were from the United States. I always end my talks by talking about East Timor, and I wish I didn't have to. But the story, unfortunately, becomes ever more relevant. It is a story of horror, but it is also a story of hope. It became particularly relevant after December 26, the tsunami that struck. Terrible natural catastrophe. By the way, that's an example of the media doing a very good thing. Focusing the spotlight where it mattered, the media rushing to that area of the world where hundreds of thousands died. And it really proves the point. It didn't matter if those orphan children were red or black or yellow, or the women or men who were suffering were black or white. What mattered is we saw human beings in pain, and the whole world responded. That's the media at its best. But what it didn't show is that there were two tsunamis that hit the hardest struck area, that area of Indonesia called Aceh. If you said that word before December 26, someone would probably say, God bless you. But after December 26, we learned that name. What the media didn't show, even though they were everywhere, was the second tsunami, and that is the Indonesian military that has had that area under a state of siege and even continued to kill the Achenese after December 26. These survivors, when some reporters, foreign reporters, would try to cover this, they would say, this is the distraction, you're not here to cover this. And before December 26, they kept out most aid workers and they continued to kick them out after December 26. They were in a terrible bind, the Indonesian military. They didn't want any journalists or relief workers in the area, but the whole world was watching. That's the power of that media spotlight. Paul Wolfowitz, by the way, visited that area soon after December 26. The Deputy Defense Secretary came back and said, we will restore military training aid to the Indonesian army. It was cut off finally in 1999 when the people of East Timor, that small country 300 miles above Australia, voted for their freedom in a UN-sponsored referendum, and the Indonesian military burned East Timor to the ground. And finally, President Clinton, after so many years, like his predecessors from Carter to Bush to Reagan back to Ford, of support for the Indonesian military, finally, in one of the last years of his presidency, Clinton said, no more. And the military training aid was cut off. And here is Wolfowitz, one of the chief neoconservatives, one of the chief architects of the Iraq War, going there, coming back, and using this suffering as a pretext to restore that military training aid. Now president of the, named president of the World Bank, makes you wonder if this is his definition of development, taking countries' monies and funneling it into repressive regimes. I know well the brutality of the Indonesian army, having survived a massacre in East Timor in 1991. My colleague Alan Nairn and I went to East Timor in 1990 and 1991. In 1991, November 12th, we were covering a procession of thousands of Timorese in Dili, the capital of East Timor. They had gone to church early in the morning for mass. So many Timorese turned out, they had to hold the mass, not inside the Motael church, the flagship church of Dili, but outside under the trees. And then more people joined, a cross-section of Timorese society, girls in their Catholic school uniforms, women in their traditional Timorese garb, boys in their Catholic school shorts. And they walked the streets of Dili to the cemetery, this geography of pain. And we followed them and asked people, why were they risking their lives in this land where there was no freedom of press, no freedom of assembly, no freedom of speech? Why did they dare put up their hands on the V sign and say, Viva East Timor, Viva Independence? They would say, for my mother, or for my father, for my sister, for my village, it was wiped out. We got to the cemetery, stuffed with the bodies of young and old, many cut down in their prime by the military over the previous 17 years. When we got there, we saw from the procession, the direction the procession had come, hundreds of Indonesian soldiers marching up with their US M16s. Alan and I knew that the Indonesian military had committed many massacres in the past, but they'd never done it in front of Western journalists. Alan was writing for the New Yorker magazine. I was doing a documentary for Pacifica Radio. This time we took out our equipment. We thought maybe we could head off the attack if it was clear who we were as Western journalists. We'd always hidden our equipment so as not to endanger Timorese caught talking to Western journalists. But now I slung my tape recorder over my shoulder. I put my headphones on and I held up my microphone like a flag. Alan put the camera above his head and we walked to the front of the crowd. The people couldn't escape. There were walls on either side of the road. The soldiers marched up 12 to 15 abreast, US M16s at the ready position. They swept around the corner without hesitation, without provocation, without warning. They swept past us and they opened fire on the crowd, gunning people down from right to left. A group of them threw me to the ground, beating me with their rifle butts and their boots. Alan got a photograph of them opening fire, then threw himself on top of me to protect me. And they took their US M16s like baseball bats and they slammed them against his skull until they fractured it. They were killing everyone around us. As we lay on the ground, Alan covered in blood, They put the guns to our heads in firing squad fashion. And they were screaming two things, politique and Australia. Politique because they were saying we were political to witness something like this. But that's our job as journalists, to go to where the silence is, to bear witness. And they were saying, Australia, Australia. They were demanding to know if we were from Australia. We knew what they meant. 17 years before, there were 6 Australian-based journalists that were covering the events leading up to the invasion. They immediately executed 5 of them. The 6th, Roger East, was reporting from a radio station in Dili. They dragged him out of it. Radio stations are so important. The most powerful means of communication, because they reach the masses. And repressive regimes understand this in every country. That's why in places like Haiti, when they play musique engagée in the first coup, or even now, they immediately go and ransack the radio stations, musique engagée being engaged music, because they know the power. They dragged Roger East, who was reporting for the world, out of the radio station as he shouted, I'm from Australia. They shot him into the harbor with so many thousands of Timorese. The Australian government hardly protested. We believe because years later, Australia and Indonesia would sign the Timor Gap Treaty, dividing up Timor's oil between Australia and Indonesia. Oil is the source of so much pain in the world. And now, 17 years later, November 12, 1991, as we lay on the ground, their guns at our heads, we shouted back, no, we're from America, America. They'd stripped us now of everything. The only thing I had left was my passport. I threw it at them. They'd kick me in the stomach. When I'd get my wind back, I'd say, America, America. And at some point, they pulled the guns from our heads. We believe because we were from the same country their weapons were from. They would have to pay a price for killing us that they had never had to pay for killing the Timorese, and they moved on. We were able to get into a Red Cross Jeep. Dozens of Timorese jumped on top of us, on top of the Jeep, and we drove like that as a human mass to the hospital. When we got to the hospital, the doctors and nurses started to cry when they saw us. We were not in worse shape than the Timorese. They had killed more than 270 Timorese on that day. But I think because of what we represent to the people of Timor, I mean all of us as Americans, and to more than the Timorese, to people in Nigeria, in Haiti, in El Salvador, all over the world. I think we represent two things, the sword and the shield. The sword, because all too often the U.S. government provides military weapons to repressive regimes or uses them themselves, like in Iraq. But also, they see us as the shield. We come from the most powerful country on earth. Every little act we engage in has a ripple effect all over the world. And on that day, on November 12, 1991, that shield was bloodied, and it just deepened their despair. 10 years later, May 19, 20, 2002, the day the people of East Timor celebrated their freedom. Over those 10 years, we had been banned from returning to Indonesia. The Indonesian military called us a threat to national security for having witnessed and reported on the massacre. We'd gotten in, gotten deported, gotten arrested. But on that day, we made it to Timor. 100,000 Timorese gathered in Tasitolo, a sandy plain just outside Dili. It was nearing midnight. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan gave his speech. And then Xanana Gusmao, the rebel leader of East Timor, the founding president of this new nation, stood up and unfurled the flag of the Democratic Republic of East Timor. There was a fireworks display, and the people looked up, and you could see the light reflected in their tear-stained faces. This nation of survivors had prevailed. They had resisted, and they had won. At an unbelievably high price, 1/3 of their population wiped out, one of the great genocides of the late 20th century. But they won. And they thanked people all over the world for helping. Sure, they were the bravest. They were on the front line. They bore the brunt of the pain, but they knew they couldn't do it alone. And they especially thanked people from the most powerful nations, who, when they stood up to their government saying not to arm human rights abusing regimes, what a difference it made for people at the target end. And it is a lesson to all of us, whether we are journalists or students, professors, teachers, doctors, nurses, librarians, shopkeepers, whether we're artists, employed or unemployed, we have a decision to make every day, every hour of every day, whether we want to represent the sword or the shield. Democracy Now!
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Brian Gregg, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Dino Pappas, Joanne Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. We welcome and need your participation too. Please contact us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. You can also live stream our show on Saturdays 2 to 4 if you are not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We leave you with this quote by Amy Goodman. "Going to where the silence is, that is the responsibility of a journalist. Giving a voice to those who have been forgotten, forsaken, and beaten down by the powerful."